want to hand in your papers? I probably should ask for them by email, but. I'll wait till you get them all up and quick. Yo. I know. That's right. If I didn't say anything, you'd get to give me anything.
Yeah,
just kind of
that's just my
other comment. Oh, okay. I notice everybody pretty much gets it. I assume you've been somewhere near English 101 or something similar. This is your chance. This is what they're telling you all day during high school. When you get to college, you have to write a paper. Thank God. It happens. All right. Don't know if I can stick to the week. I'll give it a shot on these, right, you know, weeks to get stuff back. But if I don't make it, then I got spring break. So, but I'll try and get it back. You want your exam, Tony? I am trying to think up something to do, something with a class, you know, a little class presentation or something. It's probably beyond Dante, but I haven't dreamed it up. I get tired of talking eventually. Probably get tired of listening to me. Let's give the good news. The good news on your syllabus, March 27th is the day before the midterm, the second midterm. Once again, I scheduled the midterm when I'm going to be out of town. This time I'm in Baltimore at Loyola College giving a talk, and I couldn't arrange a flight in unless I canceled the Tuesday class. So that's what I'm doing. We seem to do all right with a snow day before the last exam. So March 27th, which is the day before the second midterm, there will be no class, right? March 27th. You can email me as you did last time and try and pry out of me all sorts of secrets about, you know, the exam. That works pretty well. Yeah. Is that all right? Is that clear enough? It'd be clear if you show up here and there's nobody here. The midterm is March 29th, isn't it? No, that's still on the same day. The day before. The Tuesday before. Well, on this syllabus I'm looking at, which must be the new one, it's on the 29th. Remember the first syllabus, I didn't even have the spring break on, I don't think. So. That. I think there's actually been three of these now. And while you're looking at your syllabus, the Plato excerpt is not pages 756 to 779, it's 817 to 824. With the emphasis on the 24, not the 17, because I didn't explain very well Plato's theory of the line, but I did talk about the allegory of the cave. Right? So that's what you want to know on the Plato. Okay. On the Aristotle, you want to know those six parts of a drama. Right? That's the big thing. Plot, character, thought, diction, melody, spectacle. I think that's something you can sort of carry with you. Anything else? Now, on the issue of the parables, you were right to a certain extent. When I say the parables are difficult, that is in itself an interpretation. It's a traditional one, all right? But I have to admit, it's the intellectual justification. Might make it a little easier. I'm not trying to label anybody, but essentially the Catholic Church is a very intellectual, believe it or not, approach to to Christianity. And within the 1,000 years of very smart people thinking about these things, Augustine being the first, I don't think the comparison to Einstein is too far off. They went over every word in the New Testament, and they decided they were so smart they couldn't believe the average person could really understand this stuff, right? And they came up with esoteric, mysterious interpretations. And essentially, the mystery of religion was just that it was a mystery, just like Plato's cave. You couldn't possibly understand it unless you were an initiate, unless you studied for years, for a lifetime, unless you read deeply, unless you're really smart. Right? That was the elitist interpretation. In the Greek Orthodox Church, for example, which was the first fact we're learning today, and I'll repeat it, is in 325, Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire. But then the first thing he did is he moved the capital of the empire from Rome to Constantinople, which he named after himself, obviously. Today's Istanbul in Turkey, right? So the Catholic Church, what we think of the Western Catholic Church, is really just the Church of Rome. It was what was left behind in Rome. But as far as the rest of the world was concerned, except for those barbarian Frenchmen, the center of Christianity was in Constantinople. And the true descendants of Christianity were the Greek Orthodox Christians. You know, we have those today. You occasionally see guys in Greece with huge beards, right? And a version of that is the Russian Orthodox Church. But that's the Eastern wing of Christianity. Even today, in that Eastern wing, the mysteriousness of the whole religion is still paramount. The mass is performed by priests who stand with their back to the congregation, just as it was until 1215 in the West. And all you would hear in the congregation is a priest muttering the mysterious rites, maybe lifting up a chalice or something. But you wouldn't know what was going on. It's too mysterious. Right? So in that elitist, or even in this case, Eastern interpretation, there was the notion that these parables were said on purpose to be difficult. Right? Now, the big break in Western thought, and the tradition you're living in, most of you, is Protestantism, which came along and said, Luther essentially said, well, I can understand all this stuff, but I happen to notice that nobody else understands it. I think that there's been 1,000 years of incrustations, too much interpretation. We're losing sight of the text itself. We're missing the message. Let's go right back to St. Paul. Let's forget the 1,000 years. I'm as smart as Augustine was, and Luther was a smart guy, right? So you get rid of it, and you get a popular interpretation. And suddenly, the big issue in Protestant was that Luther said, it took a while to develop, actually, but when the dust cleared, particularly in England in the 17th century, the notion was that the average person, all the average person needed, you didn't need the church, you don't need the priest, all you need is that Bible, and you'll figure it out. So Christianity became the religion of the book, not the church. And that's, the fundamentalist Christianity in America today is still in that tradition. That's what fundamentalism means. There's somehow a notion that just you and that text will get it all figured out. And you got to admit, that's, I don't want to say anything, but I defy you to sit down and read the Bible all the way through and come out with it with any kind of understanding. It ain't so easy. Right? You are looking for somebody to explain it. Now, maybe it's not a church, a priest investment with his back to you. Maybe it's a guy on TV waving the book around. But he's still doing the same thing. He's explaining it to you because you couldn't figure it out for yourself. Okay. Nonetheless, the ideology of it is that you could, You can say, well, I like that guy on TV. I'm going to get my own show. And people think that's great, because that's really what we're all about here, is reading it, you know, understanding it for yourself. And so you get it? There's a kind of myth on both sides. Maybe it wasn't that hard that the elitists were right, but maybe it wasn't so easy that the populist view was right. But don't ask me for the answer. That's not my place here. And I'm just showing you that, that this stuff gets interpreted. But you were absolutely right to call me on it, and I should have qualified what I said as the, I went back to my source, and I realized it. The source is a book called The Veil of Allegory by a professor at the University of Chicago named Michael Murn. And he argued that you get this image quite a bit in the history of the West. The veil of allegory is what I mean by interpretation. You read it to figure it out. What does this mean? But the notion is that the author hid the meaning on you, forcing you to figure it out. It's like the dreams in Joseph. You get forced to figure out. And so he veiled the meaning. And that's an interpretation. And there was even a translation in the Bible said that when, it was a mistranslation, but it was very popular, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, in the original Hebrew, it says his face was shining bright, which makes sense, he's seeing God. But in the Latin text of St. Jerome, which was the text of the Bible everybody used, Moses comes down with his face veiled. Not bright, veiled. That's the Western tradition. Because he had seen the mysteries, so he couldn't possibly relate to a bunch of shepherds, a bunch of Jewish ex-slaves in the Sinai desert. And that's what the symbol of the veil meant. Okay. Again, and that was my point of my story, which I told really badly, about the Holy of Holies. When the Romans entered Jerusalem, the general wanted to part the curtain of the Holy of Holies. He wanted to part the veil and see the mystery. And of course, there was nothing there, because he was a mere unbeliever, pagan. He couldn't possibly comprehend the mysteries of religion. He was looking for a rock. Okay. Not an understanding. So, again, does that make some sense to you? Pretty interesting stuff. Now, this isn't a course on religion. This is supposed to be a course on literature. But these are literary expressions. You go back to our first day. This stuff did not come in a videotape or an MTV musical, okay? It came in written text, and so they get lumped into the Norton Anthology of Literature, but they, make things interesting, right? And that excuses us for getting to the Koran today. But I want to finish. Is there any question on that? I'm going to repeat some of that today. I want to finish up Augustine, but actually I went home and I said, I really have to read you a passage from The Bonfire of the Vanities about a 1987 horribly expensive, vanity-filled dinner party in New York on Park Avenue among the super wealthy. And I left it home. But I pulled out a passage from the internet, I'll read it to you anyway, because I think it gets across the point of the satyricon. With the super rich, usually also gets super pious. But it's a vanity. It's an emptiness. You might call it hypocrisy. Now there's an awful lot, I don't want to give you too much of a radical view so you can tune me out on this one, but early American settlers started to read the Bible an awful lot. Well, why not? They were feeling mighty lucky sitting here in Indiana in 1830. All that free land, no free land back in Germany where they came from. Some duke owned it all. To get out here, all you got to do is, geez, I couldn't believe it. Got mountains, rivers, plant the corn, it comes up. Yeah. No wonder they're thinking about it. But, you could argue that a vanity here, so you always want to be careful. People come from wide open spaces and go back to the old world, right? Kind of what we're in right now. Lyndon Johnson and George Bush both came from Texas. I don't know what goes on down there, but they think that the world is endless, but not necessarily so. But anyway, I want to read you this, enough of the editorial, because I just think it's funny. I don't know, you may not think it's funny, so just boo or go to sleep. You have to tolerate me occasionally. I have to read this book every year. What's the amazing thing about this, set in the 1980s, the people in this are roughly my age, but I always feel so much younger than they are. And they may even be, they're certainly a lot richer. And the hero is Sherman McCoy. This is actually kind of interesting because he's an investment banker in the fictional firm in the novel. It's called Pierce and Pierce. But it was actually based on a firm whose name I forget, but it was the big trading firm that occupied the top five floors in the World Trade Center. Okay? They were essentially wiped out on 9/11. That's what went on up there. And they're up, you know why they're on the top four, by the way. This has nothing to do with anything. Why would you occupy the top four in the World Trade Center? Prestige, pure vanity. Plus, believe it or not, the rent is cheaper up there. Right? You got to ride the elevator all the way up. You'll pay their neck to get down to a copy of the newspaper. Right? 104 elevator ride takes a while. Did anybody ever go up there? I guess you guys have. You've been up there? It's a freaky place. Anyway, here he is. And this guy's a stockbroker. He's just lost $6 million. He makes $1 million a year. He's going broke. Costs him $800 a month just to park his cars. Lives in a huge Park Avenue apartment. So I'm going to just read it. Sherman McCoy walked out of his apartment building. Again, the point is it's like the Satyricon by Petronius. It's a modern satire, making fun of people who don't see what they're doing. Heathens, you might call them. Sherman McCoy walked out of his apartment building holding his daughter Campbell's hand. Misty days like this created a peculiar ashy blue light on Park Avenue. But once they stepped out from under the awning over the entrance, such radiance. The median strip on Park was a swath of yellow tulips. There were thousands of them, thanks to the dues apartment owners like Sherman paid to the Park Avenue Association and the thousands of dollars the association paid to a gardening service called Wiltshire Country Gardens. Real English name. Do you know where Park Avenue is in New York? Vaguely. In New York, sort of the Upper West Side. Upper East Side. They paid the gardening service called Wiltshire Country Gardens, run by three Koreans from Naspeth, Long Island. There was something heavenly about the yellow glow of all the tulips. That was appropriate. So long as Sherman, and the guy, he's in big trouble. He's got a girlfriend, and he was driving her from the airport in his Mercedes, and he hit a kid in the Bronx, and they didn't stop for him because they thought they were being robbed, and he's like full of guilt and worrying that this is going to come out. So he's got $6 million, he's got this huge apartment, he's got the little daughter, and he's deathly afraid his wife's going to find out about his girlfriend, and in fact he may have hit a kid and get into the hospital. So his life is starting to fall apart. There was something heavenly about the yellow glow of all the tulips. That was appropriate. So long as Sherman held his daughter's hand in his and walked her to her bus stop, he felt himself a part of God's grace. A sublime state it was, and it didn't cost much. The bus stop was only across the street. There was scarcely a chance for his impatience over Campbell's tiny step, which is six, to spoil his refreshing nip of fatherhood he took each morning. He spends exactly 45 seconds with his kids every day. Campbell was in the first grade at Taliaferro, spelled T-A-L-I-A-F-E-R-O, which, as everybody, tout le monde, which is French for everybody, all the world, tout le monde, which as everybody, tout le monde knew, was pronounced Tolliver. Each morning, the Tolliver school dispatched its own bus driver, and children's chaperone up Park Avenue. Few indeed were the girls at Tolliver's who did not live within walking distance of that bus route. To Sherman, as he headed out onto the sidewalk holding Campbell's hand, she was a vision. She was a vision anew each morning. Her hair was a luxuriance of soft waves like her mother's, but lighter and more golden. Her little face, perfection. Not even the gawky years of adolescence would alter it. He was sure of that. In her burgundy school jumper, her white blouse with its buttercup collar, her little nylon backpack, her white knee-high socks. She was an angel. Sherman found the very sight touching beyond belief. The morning shift doorman was an old Irishman named Tony. After opening the door for them, he stepped aside under the awning and watched them depart. That was fine, fine. Sherman liked to have his fatherhood observed. This morning, he was a serious individual representing Park Avenue and Wall Street. He wore a blue-gray nail-head worsted suit, custom tailored in England for $1,800. Two-button, single-breasted, with ordinary notched lapels. That's 1987 prices. On Wall Street, double-breasted suits and peak lapels were considered a bit sharp, a bit too garment district. His thick brown hair was combed straight back. He squared his shoulders and carried his long nose and wonderful chin up high. He keeps calling it his Yale chin. Sweetheart, let me button your sweater. It's a little chilly. No way, Jose, said Campbell. Come on, sweetie. I don't want you to catch cold. No, Stayo, no. She jerked her shoulders away from him. Stayo was Jose spelled backwards. No. So Sherman sighed and abandoned his plan to save his daughter from the elements. They walked on a bit. Daddy. Yes, sweetheart. Daddy, what if there isn't any God? Sherman was startled, bowled over. Campbell was looking up at him with a perfectly ordinary expression, as if she had just asked what those yellow flowers were called. Who said there isn't any God? But what if there isn't? What makes you think? Did somebody tell you there wasn't any God? What insidious little troublemaker in her class had been spreading this poison? So far as Sherman knew, Campbell still believed in Santa Claus. And here she was, beginning to question the existence of God. And yet, it was a precious question for a six-year-old, wasn't it? No two ways about that. To think that such speculation... a genius, that kid, a genius. Put her in the advanced class. But what if there isn't? She was annoyed. Asking her about the history of the question was no answer. But there is a God, sweetie, so I can't tell you about if there isn't. Sherman never tried never to lie to her, but this time he felt it the prudent course. He had hoped he would never have to discuss religion with her. They had begun sending her to Sunday school at St. James Episcopal Church at Madison and 71st. That was the way you took care of religion. You enrolled them at St. James. And you avoided talking or thinking about religion again. Oh, said Campbell. She stared out into the distance. Sherman felt guilty. She had brought up a difficult question, and he had ducked it. And here she was, at the age of six, trying to piece together the greatest puzzle of life. Daddy. Yes, darling, he held his breath. You know Mrs. Winston's bicycle? Mrs. Winston's bicycle? Then he remembered, 2 years ago, at Campbell's nursery school, there had been a teacher named Mrs. Winston who braved the traffic and rode a bicycle to school every day. All the children had thought this was wonderful, a teacher who rode a bicycle to school. He had never heard Campbell mention the woman since then. Oh, yes, I remember. An anxious pause. Mackenzie has one just like it. Mackenzie? Mackenzie Reed was a little girl in Campbell's class. She does? Yes, only it's smaller. Sherman waited for the leap of logic, but it never came. That was it. God lives, God is dead. Mrs. Winston's bicycle, no way Jose, no say ho. They all came out of the same heap in the toy box. Sherman was relieved for a moment, but then he felt cheated. The thought that his daughter might actually have questioned the existence of God at the age of six, this he had taken as a sign of superior intelligence. Over the past 10 years on the Upper East Side, for the first time in human history, intelligence had become socially correct for girls. So anyway, that's supposed to be a satire. That's the only passage I could find on the internet quickly. So that was on Petronius, who was clearly making fun of Roman society, okay, in 60 AD, just as he's making fun of American society in the 1980s. So let's go to Augustine. And I think I'm up to about page 1118. Yeah, the three ones and an eight. And again, I just think that there's some things that, let's just walk through this. We had the account of his childhood, and obviously he's writing long after it, but he admits he's basing his own thoughts about what his childhood was like on what, you know, his infancy was like and what he'd seen of other people. But he seems to remember well enough being beaten. And in a theme that runs through this whole selection, he talks about how he didn't like reading. So this, let's start at 1116, okay? Right at the bottom of the page. And this is this passage, I'm not sure if it's well translated or what. It's a little confusing, but it's interesting to us in a history of literature class. Okay. Start five lines up. For those first lessons were the surer. I acquired the power I still have to read what I find written. He's still amazed he can read. Reading is something of a miracle. And Augustine is, right? I still have the power I still have to read what I find written and to write what I want to express. Whereas in the studies that came later, I was forced to memorize the wanderings of Aeneas, whoever he was. I'm sure this is your same thought. Okay. While forgetting my own wanderings. You see how he interpreted it right away? The wanderings of Aeneas and the wanderings of the lost soul. The wanderings of Odysseus and the wanderings of the lost soul. You come home. You know, we can't possibly care about an Odysseus in some Greek. We can't possibly care about a Roman, but we all care about our own soul. This is how Dante will read this stuff too. But you see it right in Augustine. It's my own wanderings. So they're reading allegorically. And to weep for the death of Dido, who killed herself for love, while bearing dry-eyed my own pitiful state. And that among those studies, I was becoming dead to you, O God, my life. Nothing could be more pitiful than a pitiable creature who does not see to pity himself and weeps for the death that Dido suffered through love of Aeneas, and not for the death he suffers himself through not loving you, O God, light of my heart, bread of my soul, power wedded to my mind and the depths of my thought. Okay. Skipping down a little bit after the italics. And for this I did not grieve, but I grieved for Dido, slain as she sought by the sword an end to her woe, while I too followed after the lowest of your creatures, forsaking you. Okay. Now whether he really thought that that's what Virgil was writing about, that this, the death of Dido was a story about the obstinate soul, I don't know, but a lot of people read it that way. So you see how that story got interpreted. Just because it was such a powerful story. Okay. No reason why you couldn't read it that way if you felt like it. You know, you're not going to get put in jail for misreading something, right? And the question that he started that saying he was forced to weep for Dido, and it's not clear whether he actually did. Later on page 100, on this page, it seems like he in fact did grieve for Dido when he says, "But I grieve for Dido." That he was a good reader and was really caught up in the story. It felt so miserable for poor Dido being abandoned by Aeneas. Right? Even though he was forced to go to school and forced to learn to read, yet it worked, and he learned to read. And when he did, he just was captivated by what he read. I think that's the best interpretation. And he says pretty much on page 1118. Do I have a passage? Yeah, never mind. At the top of 1118, he actually, in class, they would act out these stories, and he would actually get to act it out. Right? So that it was something of a performer. But anyway, that I make my point there, that he read this stuff deeply and with passion, and he interpreted it. At least he's interpreting it now while he's writing 30 years later, even if he didn't at the time. Okay. The second bit is this thing about the pear tree, very famous episode. This is somewhat equivalent to George Washington and the cherry tree, which is the kind of thing they make up about George Washington. But this is, whether it happened or not, it's Augustine says it did, and he's clearly making a point. He starts by talking about his lustful adolescence. I mean, he says here one line, the white light of love. He could not distinguish the white light of love from the fog of lust. Anybody see that? It's about 15 lines up from the bottom. I couldn't distinguish the white light of love from the fog of lust. Both love and lust boiled within me and swept my youthful immaturity over the precipice of evil desires. Let's go. Let me just read that. Evil desires to leave me half drowned in a whirlpool of abominable sins. Your wrath had grown mighty against me, and I knew it not. I had grown deaf from the clanking of the chain of my mortality, the punishment for the pride of my soul. I guess I actually had read it the other way last night. But it's the same general pattern. It's thinking later about his own mortality that puts him on the path to believing in right and wrong. It's the same pattern we see again, right? Sitting right there. When he was young, he could not hear the chain of his mortality. He'd grown deaf to it. Therefore, he could not think about right and wrong when he should have. He was deaf to his mortality. That's the way to say it. And 119, he talks about how he enjoyed stealing. A crime, he says, written in the hearts of men. Okay. And what he means by that, he knew stealing was wrong, yet he enjoyed it. The phrase, it's written in the heart, there's a notion here that there's certain things that are always wrong in all societies. That's why they're written in your heart. Like natural law. And he's getting this from a humanist named, a Roman humanist named Cicero. He said, you know, everybody knows, you don't need the Ten Commandments to tell you that murder is wrong. And Cicero says, and you don't need a law to tell you that rape is wrong. Everybody knows it. Right? So you can punish it even without a statute. And that was the feeling. And theft is right up there with it. You know that theft is wrong. Okay? Nonetheless, he likes to go out with his friends and steal pears from a pear tree, not because they wanted them, but precisely because they were doing something wicked. It was forbidden to steal, therefore they stole. Right? So he's really getting at all of this. There's that little delight in just doing something wrong. Right? And you can never get away from this. This will be with us for eternity, as far as I'm concerned. There will always be a kid feeling bad in high school and go out and spray paint, you know, something, right? They just want to do something bad. So the society's thing is you got to channel that energy. I say let them play football, right? Channel that energy into something useful, right? You might have some other thing you want people to do, but you really do have to take care of kids because everybody's got this little desire to do mischief. Right? So he and his friends stole pears, and he knew it was wrong because he's quite clear that he's had religious instruction. His mother is a good Catholic, right? And he's rebelling against her. Okay. Right in the middle of the page, there's he talked, this is a kind of famous passage about the desires that we feel. Each of the senses creates desires, and you've got to learn to control them. There is an appeal to the eye in beautiful places, in gold and silver and all such. The sense of touch has its own powerful pleasures, and the other senses find qualities and things suited to them. Worldly success has its glory, and the power to command and to overcome. From this springs the thirst for revenge. We just love revenge. Okay, it just feels so good. And he's just saying, you can't start dealing with people until you admit this stuff. But you can have in moderation. This is kind of Aristotelian notion. You're going to have a little lust of the eye, maybe a little revenge, but you shouldn't have too much, right? And he strangely says there can be in moderation even in friendship. Okay. Uh, on page 1121, he starts thinking about why he stole those pears. He's really trying to figure out this motivation to evil. He wasn't doing it because he wanted the pears. They didn't eat them. They weren't so beautiful to look at. He wasn't in a contest to steal the most pears. There was no ambition involved, okay? And yet, he stole them. And he decided it was that he did it to see if he could escape punishment. Okay? Just to get away with something. And then he starts thinking that that's a proof of God. Right? Which is the same thing you find in Socrates. Because as soon as you admit that there's a rule that you want to get away from, you admit that there's a rule. Okay? So you can deny God, but that's, he's saying, that's the same thing as admitting he's there. Okay? A nice little paradox. Okay? That's the point of the pear tree episode. Right? Takes you in nice and easily, right, to this whole shebang. Right? And that doesn't... All right, that's enough from me on that. So we use this episode. He's really got a little sermon going there, doesn't he? He talks about, the next section, he's talking about student life in Carthage. Read West Lafayette for yourself. Okay. He loved the girls. He loved stage plays. And the girls part is interesting. I mean, don't ask me for solutions here, but you think of societies where there's no contact with women, it's crazy. Right? There are societies like that. So you got to figure out some way for interaction, and that we have our own solutions today. He later says, you know, what you really need is marriage, but that wasn't available. Okay, but you know, everybody's going crazy. They should have just paired us up. You know? Well, we don't do that today or anything else either. So nobody's got a good solution. These things change all the time. Why did he like stage plays? And he can't quite understand it, right at the bottom of 1121. He says, you know, we watch people suffer. He's thinking of something like Oedipus Rex. We go there, we're just dying for that part where he puts out his eyes. That's really the best part. And he's saying, why do we like that? Why do we like to watch people suffer? Okay? And he just admits that he's really Aristotelian. It's a pleasure. We enjoy pitying other people. And we enjoy being moved to tears, just like you enjoy being scared at a horror movie. Basically, because you get to experience emotions without the danger. Well, he joined a bunch of, on page 1122, he essentially joins a fraternity. Kind of frat boys, and they riot. And they're called, in the middle of the page, the Eversores or the Overturners. So he was a bad guy. Right? Running around, making trouble, chasing girls, going to plays. And then he picks up a copy of Cicero, this guy. And he starts reading philosophy. And it really took. He had the intellectual experience. He suddenly changed. He started, you know, there was a guy talking about why you behave the way you do. His father had died 2 years before. He read Cicero. And then his mother is always shoving the Bible at him, so he starts reading the Bible at the top of 1123. So I resolved to make some study of the sacred scriptures and find what kind of books they were. But what I came upon was something not grasped by the proud, nor revealed either to children, something utterly humble in the hearing, but sublime in the doing, and shrouded in deep mystery. There's that elitist interpretation, right? He's reading it and he can't figure it out. And I was not of the nature to enter into it or bend my neck to follow it. When I first read those scriptures, I did not feel in the least what I have just said. They seemed to me unworthy to be compared with the majesty of Cicero. My conceit was repelled by their simplicity. just becomes a dominant theme. It actually gets buried for 1,000 years, but certainly becomes a dominant theme in Protestantism. Well, maybe not. The Catholic Church was. You have to be childlike to understand this religion. You can't think it through. Reason stops. You have to make some kind of jump. That's the deal. All right, so much for student days. Let's go to Rome. That's page. Okay, he leaves Carthage for Rome because the school in Carthage, there was no discipline. They weren't learning things. He goes to Rome. Now, it's interesting that his trip from Carthage, which is North Africa, to Rome, he's really thinking that he's another Aeneas, leaving behind Dido, which was in Carthage, right where Augustine's born. Okay, so he makes the same trip Aeneas did. A big symbolic thing, a big leap in his life. You have to leave behind the vanities. Okay, he's got some kind of mission, and he doesn't know what it is yet. Just as Aeneas had this mission to found Rome, so he's reading his own life according to the pattern of the Aeneid. That's how powerful this book was in people's understanding of themselves. Okay. Later, his mother joins him in Rome, and he does pretty well in school, and he actually gets up to Milan, and he starts learning with a guy named Ambrose, who's, I don't know if you ever heard of St. Ambrose, but this is one of the early fathers of the church, and Milan is one of the, it's not Rome, but it's one of the centers of Christianity. And on page 1125, he talks in a famous passage about watching St. Ambrose read. And you see right in the middle there, it says, when he read, his eyes traveled across the page, and his heart sought into the sense, but voice and tongue were silent. You see that line? You with me? Ambrose is reading silently, which we take for granted today. But this is telling us, this is one of the things, you know, we don't know that much about the era. It's telling us that the normal way to read was to read out loud, even when you were alone. You read out loud. It helped you get through the language. You took it slowly, right? Every word. Right? You read. And Augustine will talk, he seems to have a breakdown, and part of the thing that happens is his own voice goes. Okay, and it's not just from talking to other people, it's from reading out loud. Well, I'll leave this as I won't swear that the modern scholars haven't overturned our view of this, but at least up through the 1950s, we always read this as evidence that people generally tended to read aloud in the olden times. Okay, so that's why he's so amazed that Ambrose is reading silently. Okay. Well, Mom shows up, and she wants him to get married, and she wants him to get baptized. Okay. He's running around. He's got girlfriends. He's got illegitimate kids. Right. I mean, he's not kidding about the lust part. Right? Don't forget this. We're still in a slave society. There's brothels. There's no place for a woman. And his mother asks God for a vision. And she picks a bride for him. And I didn't mark the line, but she's 10 years old. And Augustine, by this time, is in his 30s. And nobody blinks. Okay? Nobody blinks. I'll just leave it at that. I'm not sure. This is social customs change, and we're not into it, but it seems to be a good thing to get married. Okay. Then on page 1127, it's at the bottom of 1126, just before the last paragraph. She was still 2 years short of the age of marriage. See footnote, that would be 12 or 13, therefore she's 10 years old. See that at the bottom? The next thing he talks about, he lives with a bunch of guys, and they want to form a commune. You know, men, and they can be intellectuals and stuff like this. But the wives of some of the guys are against that. They don't want the guys hanging out. Right? Yeah. They want them to come home. Okay? Augustine tells us that he had a mistress up to this point, but once he was sort of signed up to marry this girl, he had to let her go. And he sends her back to Africa. This is so cruel. And the cruelty doesn't come through, but I think Augustine's not holding back and showing us what a great sinner he was before the big moment, which comes at the bottom of it, 1127, the conversion. Okay. His vanities, he says, were his mistresses. His mistresses were his vanities. Vanity means emptinesses. You know. And he has a vision in the middle of page 1128 of a beautiful woman. And her name is Continence. You see how he's writing symbolically? Continence means control yourself. Right? We still think like that. We have a statue of liberty. Right? A woman, kind of the simplest personification. Abraham Lincoln says this country was conceived in liberty. Right? So this country was born through someone getting together with Miss Liberty. Okay? That's the image. It's perfectly acceptable, all right? But that's what the image is, and that's the same thing here. He sees Continence, and he decides he's going to fall in love with her instead of the life he's been living. Okay? He has an internal storm of sighs and tears, and he sits under a fig tree on page 1129 until he hears a little voice telling him, you know, change your ways. And he realizes in the middle of the page, well, he's well read. He knows what Christianity is all about, you know. And the first thing is poverty is supposed to be, that's the first thing Jesus says, give everything away. The sort of St. Francis thing right there in the italics, go sell what thou hast and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. So he realizes he has to give away his wealth. But you will notice he doesn't do it. He realizes he's a good person. He can interpret this. Not like St. Francis, who was a very rich son of a merchant who stood in the middle of Assisi and took off all his clothes. That's what gave away everything. But then, you know, founded a huge organization. He did it pretty well. Okay. He realizes that worldly wealth is, he interprets it to mean the vanities he'd been addicted to. He gives those up. Of giving away his worldly wealth, he reads as just giving up his, basically chasing women. That's what he's been doing. Okay. And he says in the italics, about 60% of the way down the page, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and impurities, not in contention and envy, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh and its concupiscences. So he's got this passage from Paul's letter to the Romans in his mind. And the phrase I want to point out, because it's the only time I'm doing it this semester, is put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ. Now that is a symbolic term. And even C.S. Lewis in his letters, you know, says, you know, I never quite know what St. Paul means. What do you mean put on? Okay, like he's a garment. So it's clearly these guys think, you know, think of it as interpretive language, and they're just trying to fix, it's just, they realize that Paul had this kind of weird way of talking, right? And nobody knows quite what it means. What does it mean to put him on, right? But he interprets it to mean reject the pleasures of the flesh, right? So. Now all this is taking place. What's so fascinating about this, the exact same experience is being gone through by his best friend, whose name is Alypius. And I had noticed this before, and I had to check this out, but it's pretty clear they're living together. Okay. So, I'll just throw that one out there just to stir things up. I'm getting it on tape, but I mean, hadn't thought about this, but if you believe that, you know, that if you believe we're going into a world of sin and as homosexuality becomes accepted, you're certainly going against this text, which is saying it's got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it at all. Anyway, that's an interesting moment. It's always good for people to reread before they come in to teach past. Anyway, so I'll leave that one up in the air right now. If you want to write a paper on that, go right ahead. His mother dies. That's the sort of end. And when his mother dies, he starts talking about her. By page 1130, he seems to have had a breakdown. He seems to be exhausted from teaching. He's a rhetoric teacher. He's kind of a professor of speech. Okay. But it's really fascinating that the conversion comes when he's most exhausted. Doesn't undercut it. But it certainly conforms to what you tend to see in real life, right? The guy goes to jail or kills somebody, but he'll get religion real fast, right? You take the drugs and then you figure out you need something to get you out of it. And that seems to be right here in the text, okay? He and Alypius on 1131 have clearly been living together and raising one of his bastard children. So they have adopted a kid. The two of them. Two men are living together and adopted kids. Right? Again, I did not assign this for this, but this is, I haven't taught this in 5 or 6 years, and now it's sort of, the world has changed, so you can sort of see these things, and there it is. He has given up teaching and writing because he was so exhausted, and Ambrose had told them to go and read Isaiah. Okay. Go read Isaiah, because Isaiah was where they get the idea that religion could be, the Hebrew religion could be spread beyond the Jews. Right. This huge Christian notion is right there in Isaiah, the prophet, the Old Testament prophet. Okay. Just one of the many fulfillments. He said, you know, anyway, you can look up the passage if you want. No, let's go to 11. This is getting interesting, isn't it? God. On 1132, he's talking about learning, you know, he'd worked with Ambrose and everything, and there's this discussion of the Christian heresies. And the early Christians are fighting each other for what Christianity means. And one of the things they were fighting over was called the Arian controversy. And the issue was Christ eternal from the moment the world was created, or did he come into being later? They fought this. Don't ask me the answer, but that was the fight. But still people were singing and praying, and it's fascinating, right in the middle of the page, that he says, it was at this time that the practice was instituted of singing hymns and psalms, after the manner of the Christian churches. So this is roughly 390 A.D. And up to that point, you did not sing psalms in a church service in the West, according to this. This is as good a guide as we have. That the practice of singing psalms came in as an Eastern thing, all this chanting, and it was adopted by the West, and this is the big moment. For a lot of people, you know, the hymns is what keep them out of church. Some people like it, but some people don't. I don't know if you're aware of that. You ever read Elmer Gantry? Elmer Gantry is the Sinclair Lewis novel about a preacher. And he's kind of a con man, too. But everybody loves him because he's got this great booming voice. So when the moment comes for the hymns in church, which is usually sort of like, you know, everything falls apart. When you've got some guy with a big booming baritone singing those hymns, it makes everybody feel better because then they don't have to sing. Myself, not being a singer, hymns are not the central part of my life, I can assure you. Anyway, there's that moment of hymns coming into the church. So go to 11:33. He talks about his mother's married life. I gave you the story about how she used to drink. Okay. So you get the feeling she's always an alcoholic, but he says she got rid of it. That's on page 11:33. And then she married a man who was unfaithful and beat her. But then he tells how she used to kind of charm him so that he wouldn't beat her. But you see, that's a kind of man's view. That means she's still living in terror, right? And the servants are always tattling on each other, trying to get the husband to... This is on page 11:35. You know, they tell on things, trying to get the husband to beat the servants. Right? So it's a pretty miserable life. Really, the underside of it. And that's what appeals to people. A lot of people have a miserable life. And he says the way you get out of this is the eternal light. That's page 11:36. And his phrasing for this is pretty interesting. In the middle of the page, you feed Israel forever with the food of truth, and their life is that wisdom by which all things are made. So there's that word wisdom. This wisdom is the thing that gets you out of your miserable life. Just be smart. You see it in the middle there? 11:36. Well, wisdom is this Greek word logos, which translates as the Word. So again, he's going back to the Gospel according to St. John here, sort of slipping it in. Okay. The last point, not really relevant to anything, is that when his mother dies, there's this feeling that he's got to lament out loud, and he represses it. This is a theme we trace right through the West. I had a dissertation student who was in the first class at West Point. She came here as a captain. She wrote a dissertation on female lamentation, and her point was that lamentation in the West was always considered a woman's thing. So you let women wail and weep, but men wouldn't do it. And what you see here is Augustine trying to hold in his emotions, and he does it for like a couple of weeks, and finally he gets alone and he's able to break down and start crying. Okay, but he's just holding it in because you're not supposed to hold lament. And he's doing it for an intellectual reason, because to show grief is not just a womanly thing, but it's as if to say that God isn't there and that his mother isn't in heaven, you see? You're supposed to laugh and be happy if you're really a believer. So Augustine has this wonderful tension between the sort of belief and, you know, the reality of what it's actually like to live your life, which is pretty desperate. Well, the video that goes along with this is the Greek one with Professor Rankin, and maybe I'll show a bit of that, but you can also see it at home. So let's look at the Koran now. Now, I can make these things fabulously uninteresting, and I'm sure no one converting here. Well, that's certainly the way the Koran comes across, isn't it? If you look, have you read this before or read any part of it? Okay, we're on page 11:43. Well, this is the big kahuna these days, right? A billion people for whom this is the Word of God. And you can argue that it's easier to understand than that Old Testament and New Testament. A lot easier. Okay. So let's talk about Islam for a minute. Again, on page 1143, let's just get the one point that about 10 lines down, that Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire in 325. Then he moved the capital to Constantinople. With Islam, we are 300 years later. So things are still going on in the world. In the Middle East, there's there's Zoroastrianism coming out of Persia, which is Iran. And believe it or not, and I'm no expert on this, but roughly speaking, that's the kind of religion that gave us astrology. You don't get this sort of detailed kind of astrology that you guys read in the papers today. How many of you read your stars? But astrology is actually a very late thing. It comes in around 400 AD, and it comes out of that Iranian world, right? Well, that's circulating around. The Jewish religion is circulating. Christianity is circulating around the Arabian Peninsula. They have their own customs and everything. And basically, in 610 AD, Muhammad got a vision, right? And the big moment came, 622. That's the date you got to remember. I think that was when he went to Mecca, and that was the founding of the religion, right? And they were serious believers, and there was clearly a lot of thirst for a simple form of religion, you know, that took care of all your problems and gave you modes of behavior and told you what to eat and how to behave and, you know, straighten life up, and that's what this was. And the amazing thing is it spread incredibly fast, right? Because, of course, all the young people were in favor of it. All religions, you know, are a product of 18-year-olds getting, you know, early Protestantism, early Lutherans are all average age 17 to 19, running around Germany, you know, overturning the nasty old priests and setting up the new religion. And Protestantism took off in 8 years. All over Europe, okay, and we see the same thing in the spread of Islam. And they also attached it to. They felt the need to bring it to everybody on horseback and with swords too, and they swept right across North Africa. And it only took about 50 years to get to Spain. A little slower going up the peninsula, but basically, for a couple of centuries, it was the religion on the move. It never got, due to a bunch of battles, it never got past Tours, which is northern France. It basically settled south of the Pyrenees and got around on the other side to Vienna. And there's a series of battles in Vienna over the centuries. And so it never got into the German forest, basically. Right? But it certainly moved out in the other direction. So let's talk about the text a little bit. Page 1148. It's in Arabic. It's in what's called classical Arabic. That means it's like not the Arabic people speak today, but pretty closely related to it. So you have to learn it even today, but it's a lot easier if you already have Arabic. I really want you to watch my videos on this. I want you to watch the Greece thing because that gets you to that logos. I want you to watch Turkey because I have a graduate student on the tape talking about what it's like to be a Muslim in Turkey where you speak Turkish and not Arabic. So they can't read the sacred text. Okay? Can't read the sacred text. So Turkey's always sort of drifting towards secularism, which is what's been going on this century, until there's setbacks. A major one performed by our president in the last 5 years, they started religious, you know, they got so angry at us, they started a religious revival, so they've become a kind of secular state, and now all the radical elements have been stirred up. But you get that graduate student, then you get the Arabic student, and he's fairly incomprehensible. But he gets my point across. My big point, the point you got to remember and all this. The Arabic is incredibly beautiful. It's a mellifluous language. It sounds like Allah, 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 Muhammad Rasul Allah. Right? That's called the Shahada. So what you got to do if you want to be a Muslim is say that. You don't got to go to Hebrew school. You don't have to be confirmed. Catechism. he just says that. He says, there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet. You can't get what Jesus is, right? And it sounds good. It sounds good. Now, unfortunately, my tape, he doesn't make it sound that great, right? But this is the thing to get across. It's poetry. And for this class, that's what I'm the most interested in. It's the power of the sound of the language. That's why I wanted you to hear a little Hebrew and hear a little Greek. Because literature really is so much about the sound of things as it comes across. The sense is almost unimportant. I was listening to Kanye West on the way in today. Kanye, I can't read my iPod. What's the guy's name? Kanye West. And it sounds great. Now, if you listen to it, nobody listens to it, do they? You might listen to it, but, you're not going to go out there. And I think the punchline of this song was, if you're not getting high enough, smoke cocaine. I'm pretty sure he's not serious, right? He wouldn't be saying that, right? He's not actually pushing cocaine, despite what, but it sounds great, don't you see? So we don't pay attention to the sound. We don't pay attention, most people don't pay attention to any rock and roll lyrics, okay? You can't even understand them for the most part. It takes years before you realize what people are saying. Of course, now with the headphones, I guess you hear things more clearly. But certainly rock and roll, when I grew up, was something you heard on a car radio. And you couldn't understand anything. So it was the beat, right? Not the word. Well, there's a lot of that to the Quran, right? That when you read it, it'll look pretty funny. Right? And you think, these must be really bad people to believe a lot of this stuff. But I have this feeling that people aren't really listening to the meaning of it that much. They just like the sound of it. And just like, makes them feel good. Okay? And what you notice here in these passages is that the Quran draws on the Hebrew and Christian Bible. Okay? In 610, the big moment of revelation for Muhammad was the appearance of none other than the angel Gabriel, the same guy who came down and told Mary she was pregnant. Okay. Same angel. Okay. Moses shows up. Joseph shows up. Abraham's there. Muhammad says these are great people. The message is different. And this is the point of your introduction on 11:48-49. These are his message is not that Moses founded a people, but he was a good guy. God likes good guys. And the story of Joseph wasn't that he got, he was sort of chosen and he was really smart. It was just that he was a good guy and God likes good people, even when they have flaws. And Moses had his flaws and Joseph had his flaws. The introduction, this is so fascinating because it's all about the poetic language. There are really no stories in the Quran. It's organized in these chapters called surahs. And they tell us that they're just organized by length, not by meaning. So it's just one set of prescriptions after another. It's just like law, law, law. Here's how you do this, here's how you do that. All set in the form of you're doing good if you do it this way. And you can see, just like with any holy book, if you get a bad person reading this stuff, they'll take it the wrong way. They'll have you cutting off your hand and lifting up the snake, okay, and marrying multiple women to save them. But if somebody's, a good person, they'll probably get it straight, right? The Joseph story is interesting because Potiphar's wife shows up. But she's not a tramp like she is in the Old Testament. She's just enthralled by Joseph's beauty. She can't help herself. She just thinks he's so good looking. And she and her girlfriends talk about him all the time. But he still rejects. In that story, she doesn't try and rape him, and he gets thrown into jail. He he to get away from all these women chasing him, he enters jail voluntarily. This is my problem, I know. That's the church. Right? Anyway, so let's look at just a few things. Question? Page 1151. You're allowed to have multiple wives, but the reason is to save, to have a place that you're sort of taking in orphan girls. There seems to be a problem with orphan girls, and the solution is multiple wives. Don't ask me whether this is good or bad. Okay. 1152, you notice right at the top, you get the same basic system of rewards. You get a heaven, which is described as a garden with running streams. See at the top of 1152. Or a sort of hell, which is full of fire. A garden with running streams is an appropriate heaven for the Middle East, where, you know, the water is the big thing you want. Okay? We seem to like fluffy clouds for some reason in the West. Someone explain that to me. I don't know. The dietary prescriptions are on page 1153. And kosher is okay. He doesn't want you eating swine. You notice it's close to the Hebrew traditions here. It's okay to marry Jewish women. But in 1155, it's anti-Semitic and anti-Christian. Okay, that they're wrong. Jews are deceitful, according to this, and you can't trust a Christian. And how does he know that? Well, he offered to let them become Muslims, and they didn't. So you can't trust them. Now, I don't want to belittle this, all right, because this is deadly serious stuff, and you can see if you're on the other side of this, it all makes sense. Right? My point is, good people don't pay attention to the anti-Christian element or the anti-Jewish element. They just, it's unimportant compared to the beauty of the language and the fact that this is what puts you in direct contact with God. This is the Word of God. Okay? The Quran is like the wisdom of the Word, which John says was there in the beginning. These words, this entire text, takes the place of Jesus. It was not written by Muhammad. It was written down by him, but it wasn't written by him. It was written at the first moment of creation. That's the belief. It's always there. And it's a kind of Platonic thing, right? So it's that big truth is out there, and this is all the words. You get it in this form written out, right? You see, but that's a kind of copy of the divine moment. 1156 is interesting because you have the Cain and Abel story, which I know you're all fascinated by. And this is on five short paragraphs down. Recount to them in all truth the story of Adam's two sons, how they each made an offering and how the offering of the one was accepted while that of the other was not. One said, "I will surely kill you." The other replied, "God accepts offerings only from the righteous." Is that good reading? Did I give that 3 points on the exam? I think it's a pretty good reading. Okay, I'm not saying it's the true reading, but, you know, it's the step that's left out of the Bible. And then you got these offerings, and there's nothing that really connects the offerings or the occupations to the murder. But here, he has Abel tell Cain, "I'm better than you, because God took my offering." Right? Abel must have been righteous. It makes sense that Cain wasn't righteous, and therefore that's why he was a murderer. God wouldn't take the offering from an unrighteous person. That's why God didn't take the offering, according to the Quran. According to the Old Testament, it doesn't tell you why God didn't take the offering. It doesn't say at all that Cain was unrighteous. Although you might put it together that he was, because he's the one who did the murder. Okay. Well, we got some tough laws here, though. The bottom of 1156, if you got a thief, you cut off his hand. Right? And That's what they do in Saudi Arabia, but not most of the other Muslim countries, because only our buddies there are kind of strict constructionists. 1160, you notice the ban on wine, and all out of time. Go look at the videotape, okay? They're designed for this, but I actually had enough to say in class, so I didn't have to do them. And have a wild weekend.